Welcome to Happy Hour. Happy Monday, everybody. Rather celebratory Monday afternoon. I know the Lions are playing tonight. Monday Night Football is going on. And I know there are other shows out there that want to take a little bit of the shine off the Tigers' win over the weekend. Who cares about the Tigers winning? You should be worried about tonight's Monday Night Football game. And for the rare moment in my time of doing this show, I am not coming at you with any of that. I'm not coming in here telling you, you need to be nervous about tonight's Lions game. No, I can't find myself doing that. We will get into the Lions. We will absolutely discuss them at length later on today. But I'm not going to sit here and freak out about the potential of losing to Geno Smith and the Seahawks again. And there's more than a few reasons for that. For one, when last we talked on Friday, we hadn't gotten the chance to officially celebrate the Tigers doing something they haven't done in the better part of a decade. And two, by the time I'm back on terrestrial airwaves on Friday, we'll already be past the Houston Astros series. If you're listening over at Solid State Radio, we won't have the chance to talk about the Tigers until well into tomorrow's show because the game will be going on by the time I hit the air. And there'll be plenty of time to overreact to whatever the Lions do tonight, tomorrow, the rest of the week, really. But we only get really a day to celebrate this and bask in it before the Tigers get back to business. And I will say, well, for one, we will talk about the Lions plenty before we get out of here today. We do have a game tonight. Of course, we'll be doing our usual game preview things and stuff of that nature. But I wanted to lead it off with the Tigers today because this was a team that was not in any way, shape, or form supposed to even be here right now. They weren't supposed to be a contender. They were supposed to be like 10 games under 500. They sold at the deadline and didn't even have that much to sell, seemingly, at the time. But somehow, A.J. Hinch and Chris Fetter and company managed to cobble together a pitching staff that has been the best in baseball over, like, the last month. And they're getting timely hitting just enough of it when they need it. Take a listen to some of the fun from Friday night.
The strike one. Through the legs of the catcher Lee, Rogers scores. Meadows to third, Ibanez to second. That's a pass ball that allows the Tigers to take a 1-0 lead here in the fifth. The 1-2 fly ball, left center field. This one's deep. Benintendi back. He will make the catch deep into the gap. Meadows will trot home. Ibanez to third. 2-0 Tigers. Great swing from Matt Buehrling. First pitch, swinging a fly ball, center, deep. Going back, Fletcher, that ball is off the wall. Ibanez is in. Buehrling will be held at third. Green into second. Deep double up the wall and straightaway center. 3-1 Tigers in the seventh. Malloy 1-0 bounces again, this time off of Corey Lee into the White Sox dugout. Buehrling in to score. Tigers take a 4-1 lead.
And that sets us up for the final play. Jason Foley comes in. One out yet to get in the ninth to send this thing off to the postseason. Dan Dickerson on the call.
Vaughn waiting on the strike one. Foley sets, holds a glove at the letters. The pitch, swinging a fly ball, softly to right center. Parker Meadows waving off Perez. They collide. Perez makes the catch. Tigers are back in the postseason. They pour out of the dugout. Let the celebration begin. Oh, man, this team believes. 8 games under, 10 games back, 7 weeks ago, they just kept working. Committed to playing the game the right way, winning games 90 feet at a time. It is complete team baseball. These guys are playing for each other. They're playing for these great fans, and it's led to one of the greatest finishes you will ever see. October baseball is back in Detroit.
Yes, it is. And I, for one, couldn't be more excited for it. I did actually end up down in Detroit for Saturday's matchup against the White Sox that ultimately got delayed for, like, forever, ultimately getting way, like, getting underway about 2.5 hours late and was still kind of pouring a bit. Like, we got lucky. We got among the few seats in our section that were actually covered, so that was kind of nice. But you could tell everyone was still partied out from the night before, including the Tigers, who didn't show up really the rest of the weekend. But honestly, it didn't matter. Didn't really matter what ended up coming of that. Tigers had already done what they needed to do. They had done more than anybody could have possibly expected. If you have told me at the All-Star break that this team would be making the playoffs, I would have told you you were out of your mind. And I don't think anyone would have disagreed with me. But they did, and they'll now be taking on the Houston Astros in a 3-game set. And I'm going to plead a little bit of ignorance here. I didn't realize, because it's been so long since we've had this whole wild card series, and I haven't admittedly paid as much attention to playoff baseball as I should, with the Tigers not being involved in it. I was not aware of the fact that in that wild card round, the away team doesn't get a single home game. And the other kind of disappointing thing about this is that all of the games, middle of the week, 2:35 starts, which is going to be major distraction for me at work for the rest of the week, which I'm not really looking forward to, but it is what it is. But yeah, 2:30 starts for all three of these games. They're all in Houston. And I'm not going to say that you can't take this series, because anytime I've said, oh, the Tigers can't beat this team, up to and including the Orioles and both series they played against them, I ended up being, well, horrifically wrong on that point. The key thing, though, in this case is going to be making sure that you get it done in Game 1, as Game 1 is probably going to be the only one where you have a true traditional starter, that being Tarek Skubal, who is set to get the mound tomorrow against Framber Valdez for the Astros. And I'm not going to take a whole lot from Saturday and Sunday's losses to the White Sox. You already punched your ticket to the postseason. You weren't really worried about it. You didn't need those games really that much. And it was honestly more important to make sure that your guys that you need to be rested for tomorrow, Wednesday, and Thursday to be rested for tomorrow, Wednesday, and Thursday. Given that thus far, though, that Houston has by far had a better offense than you have. They're 8th in the league in OPS to finish the year, 11th in runs scored, while you're 23rd and 19th in those categories. You absolutely need the pitching to come through, and that's really going to be key in taking this series. Like, Skubal needs to come out there and have, well, the kind of performance you've expected, you've come to expect from Tarek Skubal for you to win this series. You get down by one in this thing, and I don't like your odds at all. Winning one bullpen game in this series? Yeah, I can see it. We've seen it happen. I would not put it past the Tigers to do it. They've done it plenty. Do I like the idea of you being down 0-1 in a 3-game series and then having to come back with 2 bullpen games to win it out? A lot less so. That doesn't seem like a particularly ideal scenario for this team. Then again, I could be wrong about that, though. We've watched this team do multiple bullpen starts. Like, I think 3 out of every 5 guys in their rotation were basically an opening pitcher, and that seemed to work out pretty well. You've got a bunch of young guys that, in the case of a lot of the Astros, they haven't faced a lot of these guys ever. I mean, the Tigers haven't played the Astros since June. Half of the pitchers or more on your roster weren't even on this team last time you played Houston. Like, obviously, they'll have seen Skubal and Breisky and Casey Mize and Jason Foley, and that's about it. They've not seen any of these other guys. Jack Flaherty and Andrew Chafin are long gone. Mason Englert and Joey Wentz got fired out of a cannon. These aren't guys that will be facing the Astros this time around. The guys that you do have that you're really counting on in a lot of high-leverage situations, Houston hasn't, none of their hitters have had to face these guys. And I think that sort of element of surprise is the thing that works in the Tigers' advantage here. They're not really sure what to expect against, you know, Sean Gunther, or Ty Madden, or Brendan Hanafy. All these rookie guys they called up. Jackson Jobe, they have like 2 games of film on him, and that's about it. He's only appeared in like a couple games. So that seemingly is where the Tigers could have the advantage when it comes to the pitching. No one really knows a whole lot about most of these guys, haven't seen a whole lot of them. And that seems like a place where the Tigers could actually do fairly well. And then, of course, you can't really forget about the A.J. Hinch thing, because Hinch knows of quite a few of those hitters. Like, a lot of the guys who were on that roster were there when he was managing them to World Series. So that helps somewhat as well. So normally I would just go ahead and line this one up, not knowing, you know, just off of the rosters and what we know about these teams, just off box scores and things, it would be easy to just write this off as, okay, this is going to be like a two-game sweep for the Stros. But knowing what the Tigers have managed to do here in the last month or so, month plus at this point, I can't say that. I absolutely can't say that. And in fact, I think the Tigers might have a great deal of advantage in that regard, which is weird when you're talking about a team that has like one legitimate major league caliber starter. Now, granted, that starter also happens to be an all-star and, you know, the best pitcher in Major League Baseball right now. But it just seems weird to say that, and yet I still feel surprisingly confident. And no matter what, you're playing with house money, right? Like, no one expected you to be here. You didn't expect to be here. So, I mean, you can't really say that you're going to be disappointed if that is the way this goes. Like, whatever. We weren't even supposed to be here. Any, you know, extra bonus postseason fun is just a bonus at this point. So ultimately, if it ends this week, I mean, I can't really be that upset about it. But if somehow you manage to do the seemingly unthinkable and we get another week of baseball here in Detroit, I'm 110% here for it. And I feel like you should be able to at least hang in there against Cleveland in an ALDS matchup. We'll see how it goes from here, but the big thing is got to beat Houston. Got to win game one, get Scooble out there to throw some of that dominant ball that he does, and from there just throw some of those rookie guys that they don't have any game film on yet, and they'll never know what hit them. It is happy hour. Stick around. Plenty more to do today. We'll get into Lions coming up in a bit. So at this point, I feel like the question has to be asked about your Detroit Tigers. You've already made the postseason against seemingly impossible odds. How far can you take it from here? What is the ceiling for this 2024 squad? I feel like it's a legitimate question. And I feel like being bounced in the first round is not necessarily a foregone conclusion. Like I said, of course, in the last segment, that is going to come down a lot to winning the first matchup. Framber Valdez and Tarik Skubal going at tomorrow, and thus far, they're the only matchup that has actually been announced by either side. In our case, I know it's because it's going to be bullpen games to wrestle away. Breeski's probably going to get one of those starts. Maybe Tyler Holton gets the other or something. More than likely. Maybe they throw Reese Olson out there for one of the two. Hard to say, honestly, how they're going to play this thing. But the Astros being a bit coy about how things are going to go from here is a bit odd. But looking at what we do know with Valdez, we know he's an extreme ground ball pitcher, and he doesn't necessarily give up a whole lot of hits. You're definitely going to want to work him deep into counts. You're going to be probably trying to steal second more often. We also know he's got a tendency to not be the greatest fielder in the world, which is really not good when most of what you do is inducing ground balls. So that's something that could potentially play to your advantage. And just because Skubal, a guy who is the best pitcher in Major League Baseball right now, I feel like you should be able to get that win there. And if you do, Then we have a series. The question all the way around is what comes next? For the Stros, it'll probably be Hunter Brown or Kikuchi, maybe even Ronel Blanco. Like, you have so many options to go to there, none of whom are named Justin Verlander, that it really doesn't even matter who they throw out for those two games, like, you have a good chance of winning with any of those guys. But the Tigers, you might throw out Reese Olson or maybe Keuter Montero, except that he's not really generating a whole lot in the way of strikeouts for whatever that might be worth. But the bullpen, that is your key here. And you have a team that has basically answered the question, what would happen if we just started the bullpen every day? And as it turns out, the answer is not as ridiculous as you might think. And the Stros, beyond Josh Hader and Brian Abreu and maybe Ryan Pressly, that's really all they've got depth-wise. Those three, and Caleb Ort, you could certainly make an argument for. But the bullpen is basically the entire reason that the Tigers are even here, and it's hard not to give that group the advantage in this matchup. And I feel like, you know, a little bit of a potential spoiler here, there's a little bit of potential for Jackson Jobe to just do some postseason heroic things. In the two games that he pitched at the end of the regular season, he threw four scoreless innings. And it would seem that he's going to be made a big part of the strategy for the bullpen going into this series. I would imagine, honestly, that he ends up being called, if the way he was used here was any indication. And I kind of thought when he got called up, all right, there's one of two ways this is going to go. Either they're going to use him as an opener, they're going to have him like go through the first two innings or first six hitters in the lineup, or they're going to put him in late in games in some like high leverage, not necessarily closer-like situations. And the way he's been used thus far would seem to trend towards the latter of those two things. The Tigers clearly have a lot of trust in the guy. Well, they should. I mean, he's the best prospect in their system right now. But to call him up a week before the end of the season shows me that A.J. Hinch and company have some plans for this man in this postseason. Like, he's not going to be, like, the last guy out of the bullpen. He's going to be asked to get a lot of outs in high leverage situations, in very crucial moments in games. And I truly believe he'll end up being up to the challenge. I think this is where 90% of your ability to succeed in this series is going to come into play, and it is that bullpen. Otherwise, I mean, for the most part, you've got the advantage when it comes to the outfield, with the exception of Kyle Tucker, of course. Yordan Alvarez is hurt. He's not playing at 100% if he plays at all, and if he does play, he's going to be DHing strictly. But elsewhere, you don't really have an everyday guy out there, out in left at the moment. It's either going to be Jason Hayward or Mauricio Dubon. Whereas the Tigers are pretty set in left field with Riley Green. Of course, Parker Meadows, what a story he's been. He came back from the injured list in August and hit 291 and was just making highlight reel plays in center field. And that has been such a huge boost to this club and really the spark behind that offense here in the waning months of the regular season. Whereas Houston there has Jake Myers, who is probably every bit as good defensively, but can't hit his own weight. Like I said, Kyle Tucker is the guy where you've really got where the Stros would have the advantage. Since he came back off of the injured list from a fractured shin, he's like hitting to the tune of 365, 453, 587 slash line. The Tigers are not exactly weak in this area. You've got Kerry Carpenter, Matt Vierling, and Winciel Perez, all of whom are very solid in their own right. The infield is where the advantages really pile up, with the exception of first base, oddly enough. We'll get to that in a minute. Really pile up for the Stros. Obviously, Jose Altuve versus Cole Keith, who are you taking all day long, defensively or offensively? Yeah, come on. Shortstop. Yeah, Trey Sweeney has been a lot better defensively than the guy he replaced, even if he's not hitting. He's still hitting far better than Javi Baez, but that's not really saying a whole lot, whereas Jeremy Pena is just doing normal Jeremy Pena things. Third base has been kind of a platoon, of course, for this team between Chase Young, Vierling, Andy Ibañez, And each of them certainly has their own set of strengths and shortcomings. Like, Ibanez is absolute death against lefties, which, oh, would you look at that? The guy starting in game one happens to be a lefty. This could be, you know, somewhat of an advantage here. But the Stros do ultimately still have Alex Bregman, a guy that I have mentioned before I would really, really like to see in Detroit. I'd like to see the Stros make a play, or the Tigers make a play for him this offseason. I wouldn't mind shoring up third base for a at least the short to medium term until we decide whether Chase Young is going to be the guy going forward. And ultimately, even if he is ready to go and ready to be an everyday guy, you'll find a room for the bats where you can. Like, that's the thing. A good manager is never going to complain, oh, I have too many bats playing the same position in the lineup. Whatever will I do? AJ Hinch is smart enough to figure it out. But in the meantime, that's one where the Stros definitely have an advantage. Certainly at first, I mean, Jose Abreu was not good, got cut in June, and still there's not a whole lot of great options for the Stros there, so much so that they might have to put Yainer Diaz there, who normally plays catcher. Torque has, since coming back, well, he's been better, a lot better than he had been going into his stint in Toledo. But we are about up against it. We had to hit a break. Erica Frisbee standing by at the news desk after ABC News covers the world at 6 o'clock on WMIC AM and W237 EQ FM Sandusky. Happy hour, picking up where we left off before the break, talking about the Tigers and what is their ceiling in the postseason. We are kind of getting into the Astros matchup and the places where really that's not nearly as lopsided of a thing as you might think looking at it on paper. Should the Stros win this series? Absolutely they should. I mean, they're playing about as hot as they have all season long. Of course, Detroit is too, but Houston's also the team with the expectations. They've been to the ALCS 7 years in a row. They are always expected to be favored in a matchup like this, and for good reason. But that also, in a lot of ways, means the pressure is on you to continue, to keep that streak up, to keep it going. And Detroit, meanwhile, is a team that is playing with no expectations whatsoever. They're not playing with any pressure because they weren't even supposed to make the playoffs. And when you look at the records, and when you look what these teams have done in the regular season, this isn't a lopsided matchup by any means, and there's no reason to think that Detroit isn't capable of continuing what they've been doing to this point in the season. I certainly don't see any reason why they can't keep it going. Certainly there are reasons why Houston could do what they do best and make it through this round, but it's going to be, I think it's going to be a full three-game set no matter what happens. Like, the Tigers aren't going to be the easy out that the Stros think they are, and the Astros aren't exactly going to drop two games in a row to Detroit, I don't think. From there, though, the winner of this series would go on to take on the Cleveland Guardians. Can you beat the Cleveland Guardians is the question, I guess? The regular season would seem to suggest as much. You lost the first three-game set to them. Then you came back and took three in a four-game set after that. You split a four-game set after that. You dropped a couple at the end of July. But it's not like you're entirely incapable of beating this team, I don't think. Do they certainly have some great players over there? I mean, Jose Ramirez is a guy who's probably going to end up being a Hall of Famer. Andrés Giménez and Brian Rocchio are about as good as they get. Stephen Kwan is fantastic, certainly. Like, he's really stepped up the power this year, too. And there's really no arguing that Emmanuel Clase is the best closer in Major League Baseball right now. If it comes down to a battle of bullpens in that series, though, yeah, do you have the best guy on the back end? Absolutely you do. But beyond that, I still think I like the Tigers' odds there. I mean, as far as starters go, you've got Tanner Bibee and Ben Lively, and that's really, at this point, about it. You've got four really good guys at the back end of the bullpen in Cade Smith, Hunter Gaddis, Class A, and Tim Herron. But the Tigers, like I said, bullpen's been their biggest strength. Like, their bullpen can come in, and it doesn't matter who they throw out there, they're capable of getting outs when they need to. And given what an outsized role they play on this pitching staff, just due to the fact that they are starting a lot of games for Detroit. Like, if Bibee or Ben Lively gets blown out of a game pretty early, where are you really going from there? Like, obviously, you've got four really good guys on the back end, but who's really bridging things the rest of the way? Who's even going to be the third starter for Cleveland? Like I said, you've got about four really good arms in the bullpen, two really good arms in the rotation, and then it drops off pretty significantly from there. So I'm not even going to say that you can't beat Cleveland in a five-game series. From there, am I supposed to believe you can't beat the Orioles? You already did it four of the last six times you faced them. The only pitcher in that rotation that really scares me is Corbin Burnes. Obviously, you had a few guys who were hurt when the Tigers last faced them in the on the offensive side of things who are now back. But for the most part, you handled this team fairly well in both of those two series. I think you could beat the Orioles if that's who your matchup is in the ALCS, if you get that far. Do I question maybe a little bit whether you can get past the Yankees? Perhaps a bit. But honestly, I'm not entirely sure about that lineup either. I mean, obviously, Aaron Judge. I mean, dude tears the cover off the ball. It's just what he does. One of the best in the league at what he does. But here's the thing. Beyond him and, like, Juan Soto, Jazz Chisholm Jr., and Austin Wells, there's not a whole lot else. Who else are you really scared of in that lineup at this point? Anthony Rizzo, Gleyber Torres? Like, most of your infield is hitting about a collective 245. To be quite honest, beyond Judge, Soto, and Chisholm, I don't feel like there's really anyone on that in that batting order that you're really afraid of. As far as your bullpen goes, Clay Holmes has been perhaps a little bit shaky this year. He's rocking like a 3.14 ERA. And the rotation really is questionable at best. I mean, Gerrit Cole has shown flashes of still being Gerrit Cole of old, but for the most part, it's there's a lot of question marks there. I don't necessarily know that you can't beat the Yankees in a seven-game series. Is it likely? Yeah, perhaps not. But there's no reason for me to just sit here and say that there's any team right now that the Tigers could potentially face in the American League that they don't have the ability to go in and at least hang tight, if not beat, in any round of these playoffs. Now, when you start getting to the National League, okay. It's pretty obvious at this point that the NL is the far superior league this season. Like, I could see any of those teams ultimately making it in. The Dodgers are certainly the favorites, by any means. The Padres could honestly get there too, I think. You could make a lot of argument for the Padres, how they've played, between some of the best pitching bullpen or rotation anywhere in MLB, and also Manny Machado just tearing the cover off the ball. There's certainly a case to be made for him, though I think obviously the favorite is Ohtani and the Dodgers, and for good reason. And I'm not really convinced that you can necessarily beat... You're not beating the Dodgers in the World Series. That's just not happening. If it were to end up being the Padres, last time you faced them, you lost two of those games. But you did keep it close in all but the first one was a 3-0 loss. But you were pretty close and, in fact, took them to extras in game two of that set. I'm not sitting here saying the Tigers are going to win a World Series, that they're the team of destiny or anything like that. But all I'm trying to get across here is that it's not necessarily crazy to think that this team, as it's constructed, couldn't potentially go on a run and really be a team that no one wants to run into in the playoffs. I wouldn't put it past them. I made that mistake with this team the end of this season. Oh, there's no way. That's cute that they're going for this, but they're not really going to, right? No, they're not going to make the playoffs, right? So why can't I be a little bit optimistic now and think, you know what? I don't think there's a team certainly on the American League side of things, that you absolutely, positively cannot beat. Likely, maybe not, but I'm not writing any of it off is all I'm saying. We will get to, I promise we will get to the Lions coming up, as we do have a game tonight. And while I am not on the ledge about this like some people are, I do think there is certainly some cause for concern with this matchup. We'll get into that coming up as we get towards the end of this thing this afternoon. In the meantime, we have to hit a break, and in fact, we've got to get a quick check of your forecast for the evening. Currently, you are sitting at 71 degrees in downtown Sandusky under partly cloudy skies. John McMurray has the details of your forecast coming up next on The Voice of the Thumb, WMIC, AM 660, and 95.3 FM. So I did not forget about your Detroit Football Lions as we get set for a Monday night showdown against the Seattle Seahawks. Oh no, did not forget about that at all. I know there's a lot of people out there, and certainly I've heard a few other shows today going on about the Lions, and like, why are we all like, great, the Tigers made the playoffs, but you need to be nervous, you need to be scared about tonight's game. And I will tell you, I have a few concerns. Certainly, no doubt about that. But I am not, however, ready to just write this thing off. Oh, they don't have a chance. They're going to lose, and it's going to throw the whole season into chaos. And admittedly, if the Lions were to lose tonight's game, that does not put you in a great situation when it comes to making the playoffs. I get that, especially with Minnesota continuing to do what they do. Like, this would certainly not put you in a great position in the NFC North. But I don't also think that it's going to happen. It is rather interesting to note, by the way, the Lions have not made a whole great deal of roster moves. In fact, they have not chosen to elevate a single player from their practice squad, which seems kind of odd, considering that, among other things, Ify Melifonwu was placed on injured reserve, so that spot is going to remain vacant. You also don't have Frank Ragnow. Graham Glasgow is expected to start at center in his absence. There's not really a whole lot behind him. Meanwhile, Brian Branch is doubtful to play. He got downgraded on Sunday due to an unspecified illness. I believe he's not going to play tonight, which means you have Kirby Joseph, Brandon Joseph, and Lawrence Strickland, who is an undrafted rookie. These are your options, basically. And then the defensive front. Both Derek Barnes and Marcus Davenport were placed on injured reserve. And Josh Pascal is expected to be the guy to replace Davenport. It's going to be kind of a by-committee thing when it comes to replacing Barnes, which certainly these things are not ideal. But it does give you the sense that the Lions have a great deal of confidence in their respective next men up, that they're not worried about trying to replace these guys. They're not overly concerned about trying to fill those roster spots and call guys up to play in those positions. It would certainly suggest that they feel fairly comfortable with what they have going into tonight's matchup against the Seahawks, for better or worse. And certainly, when it comes to linebackers, you do have a fairly deep bench to replace Derek Barnes. And obviously, Pascal is the guy to fill in as your other edge rusher opposite Hutch. So, I mean, certainly some concerns, but apparently Dan Campbell and company are not as concerned about this. And suppose that's fair. Here's what's interesting, though. For as much as the Lions are banged up in a lot of ways, there is at least one bit of good news on the Lions side, and that is that Sam Laporta is expected to be good to go for tonight, for what it's worth, as is Lee McNeil and Dan Skipper. But what's really something that could benefit the Lions is that the Seahawks' defensive line is absolutely decimated. Leonard Williams is out. Byron Murphy is out. Boye Mafe is out. And Uchenna Nwosu also who has yet to play this season, admittedly, but these are guys who are very big losses potentially for the Seahawks. May is the guy who leads the Seahawks in sacks and pressures. Williams is third in those categories, and Murphy was fifth in pressures, which certainly would seemingly bode well for Detroit, I would think. And it also potentially opens you up to be able to keep up that performance with this team's ground game. I was a bit concerned with losing anyone on your O-line, how that could bode for the Montgomery-Jahmyr Gibbs combination. But it seems like with all the guys that they're missing, this could be an advantage suddenly for Detroit. Also, I would imagine that this will make life a lot easier for Jared Goff in general, too, as the Seahawks lead the league with 71 pressures on the season. And while Hutch may be the number one pressure-generating guy in the league, Seattle has three of the other, like, top six. And those three are now not playing. And so I know the obvious thing is, okay, so that means Jared Goff's going to have a lot better time out there tonight. And yes, you'd be absolutely right on that. But it'll be interesting to see now just how much of an impact that has on your run game too, because you're losing that many strong guys up on your front seven. That is going to make life certainly probably a little bit easier for Gibbs and Montgomery. And when you look at what they've done so far this season, the pressure that they've generated, it is impressive. Can't take it away from them by any means. But it's come against some, shall we say, less than stellar competition. They opened the season up against the Broncos and a rookie QB in Bo Nix. So, I mean, okay, good for you. You put a bunch of pressure on a guy who's never played in the NFL. Look at you go. Week two, you took on the Patriots, who are a dumpster fire. Week three, you trotted out Skylar Thompson because Tua Tagovailoa was hurt. It was in concussion protocol, and who knows if he's ever going to play again at this point. And then Skylar Thompson was so bad that they had to take him out and put Tim Boyle in. Yes, the former Lions legend, Tim Boyle. So it's not like they've faced the toughest of competition, and it really doesn't say as much as you would think about that Seattle front seven. Hutch has had to earn every pressure, every sack. They haven't been playing garbage teams by any means. He's had to work for what he's got, and he absolutely has. Not saying these guys aren't, but I feel like there is a bit of a question. Like, is this defensive line really that good? Or is the competition that they're facing really just not so good? And I feel like it's a fair question to ask. How much can you really glean from these results, given that they've been facing, no offense to any of these teams, but they've been facing teams that are absolute trash. Like, what am I supposed to really read into that at that point? I mean, realistically. So from there, the Lions actually faced a pretty stout defense in that division last week, and Montgomery and Gibbs averaged 4.8 yards a carry. And if Seattle is as good as advertised, I feel like so is Arizona, and you managed to gash them pretty good. Now, obviously, the downside of that is going to be that Frank Ragnow is not playing. That's going to hurt a lot. No doubt about it. I mean, Glasgow is going to be your center. And taking over at guard, I would guess, would be Coyote Oshika. He's probably going to be getting the start where Glasgow normally would be. So that's going to affect things to an extent. No doubt about that. And you do still have, with Seattle, you do have to still worry about guys like Jaron Reed and Jonathan Hankins, no doubt. But on the edges, it seems like you should have you should be able to scheme fairly effectively with the losses that they've got. But the odds in my mind, you're missing four of your front seven, your Seattle. The Lions are missing Ragnow. I feel like that favors Detroit. And I certainly think it favors the run game, and it should hopefully allow Jared Goff to feel a lot less pressure and make fewer careless decisions and hopefully be able to capitalize on that. And particularly the injuries where they are really should allow you to run behind Sewell and Decker on the edges more, which should ultimately result in the running game matching its performance from last week. Could we see Gibbs and Montgomery run for 100-plus each? I feel like it's not outside of the realm of possibility. I feel like we definitely get one of them to do so. I would love to see both, though. But this, I think, is going to be very key to winning this thing, is that, you know, you have a matchup that very much favors you on the ground with the injuries and all the guys that are missing on the front seven for the Seahawks. So that should help immensely. And then Jared Goff. You really need him to step it up this week. Seattle, they've put pressure on QBs. Like we said, they've been better at than anybody in the league. Who have they faced? This is the best QB they have faced to this point in the season. And the Seattle secondary is certainly very good. But it's also hard to, like I'd said earlier, it's hard to glean a lot from the showing you've made against some really not all that impressive talent. So if Goff doesn't try to rush plays here and the O-line is able to sufficiently give him time, I feel like you're going to have a much better chance of pulling off a W here. The other thing with the Seahawks is they don't really blitz a whole lot. They're like bottom seven in the league there. And that's when they have all their full, healthy, normal starting front seven. So that would seem to play into your favor as well. Other thing that really could kind of work out to your advantage, though, is that Seattle's not very good at pass protection. And while Geno Smith has been a nightmare for the Lions in seasons past and been a nightmare for this defense in relatively recent history, you kind of saw last week that finally, it seems like this team is figuring out how to adjust to guys who play in the style that Geno does. I mean, you saw what they did, how they by and large managed to contain Kyler Murray last week. And you really got to see serious improvement in the Lions scheming against mobile QBs. Thing that's going to be difficult, of course, is that you don't have Marcus Davenport. You don't have Derek Barnes. So it's going to be very much a kind of a rotating cast of characters, other than Josh Pascal is going to be the guy on the edge. But I do think that it's still a matchup that very much favors the Lions here. And you're also working with a reserve right tackle. Your normal starter there, Abraham Lucas, he's out at present. And his backup, George Fant, also ended up on injured reserve. So you're now facing a third stringer in Stone Forsythe, who has 47 games of experience but has only started one game prior to this season. That would seem to bode pretty well for you there, and Hutch is definitely going to give you plenty of hell if you're him. For what's worth, though, you are basically facing the coach that knows Hutch better than just about anybody in Mike McDonald, who got hired this offseason as Seattle's head coach. Like, he gets a lot of credit for developing Hutch at Michigan, and you expect that he knows better than anybody what Hutch is capable of. Hopefully, Hutch is going to really put on the afterburners here, because you are going to need him to be absolutely on his game. Like, you need him to be that elite edge rusher that you know he can be, especially with the questionable help that he's going to have on the other side. But there's a very solid game plan, I think, to beat this team ultimately. Dominate on the ground. You know, let the let Hutch be Hutch and do what he does. And if he steps up the way that you need him to, that should pose some just terror for Geno Smith. Like I said, we have the kind of blueprint to contain him at this point. And the Seahawks injuries should really help things out a long way towards steadying Jared Goff, getting him settled, having him not operate on just frazzled nerves, and allowing him to be patient enough to be able to do what he does best. And it should be a win. If you don't win tonight, then we really have to start asking some serious questions about whether this team is who we thought they were. But at least on paper, the matchups very much favor the Lions. We'll see if it actually plays out that way, though. We're going to hit a break. We'll come back. We'll close this thing out next. It is Happy Hour. Stick around.
That's it. It's over.
Jack Daniels!
I think we've just about covered all our bases as far as the Lions go. We've kind of established really what they are going to have to do to beat up on Seattle tonight. Of course, you can hear that game over on our brother station, 97.7 WTGV, the Thumb's Greatest Hits, I believe 7:15 the time on pregame for that. But other relevant things happened locally in football over the weekend. Kind of want to do a couple of those real quick. Notably, the fact that Michigan almost blew it on Saturday against, checks notes, Minnesota? Wow, that was a thing that happened. Okay. Interestingly enough, by the way, they have now fallen outside the top 25 per ESPN's FPI, for whatever that might be worth. Like, they had a comfortable lead for the majority of that game. I thought, okay, it's a foregone conclusion they're going to win this thing. But they completely and utterly collapsed in the fourth quarter. And that's not something that should be accepted by a team that has the aspirations that Michigan does. You're now looking at like a per FPI, the 1.4% chance of winning the Big Ten, which is actually lower than it was before you beat USC. And also means you have a 9% chance of making the college football playoff. And you really kind of run into a lot of problems here. Like the thing that had been by and large the strength of the Wolverines, that being that their run game can just absolutely grind you down. They're very good at that historically and over the last few seasons. But the problem is now defenses can basically sell out on the pass and stuff the run game because they know you are not a passing threat whatsoever. On top of that, you don't really have a whole lot of depth defensively, which means that you come out of the second half and teams have figured out how to start wearing down your defense and getting back into games. And this is something that could really come back to burn Michigan real quick, possibly as soon as this weekend against Washington. A team that is absolutely, I hesitate to say this is a must-win for Michigan, but it's kind of a must-win for Michigan. Like, people had already kind of jumped off the bandwagon before USC. You did scrape out a win there, and you're now seeing just how this whole idea of just running the ball down other teams' throats because we can't really pass is really coming back to burn them, and teams are seeing that and starting to use that to their advantage. Because that's those are the things that Michigan has been known for. They've kind of been their calling card, is that your defense is absolutely elite and your run game can run it down the throat of anybody in the country. And when you can't do those things, what do you have left? Not a whole lot. You have a QB that's just completing 55% of his passes and really just missing horrendously a lot of times. Like that interception against Minnesota, That's the sort of thing that Michigan fans were worried was very much a real possibility. And then that nightmare absolutely came true. When he missed to Colston Loveland, that you could make an argument that that was kind of a turning point in this thing. Minnesota then proceeded to score touchdowns on their next three drives. Orji's only averaging here 6.65 yards per completion. Let alone, you know, yards per attempt. Oh, good Lord. And he's not any kind of threat to chuck the ball downfield. That plus the turnovers equals how are you going to beat anybody now that teams have kind of figured out the key to stopping your run and wearing down your defense? Like, you can't really count on Alex Orji to step up and be, like, the guy from a passing standpoint. He just doesn't really seem to have that skill set. That's not what he does best, and it's something that other teams have figured out because they're going to just pressure him into making stupid throws. So what do you do from here? I can't answer that, certainly. How do you fix something that is, I mean, technically you're still winning these games, but how are you going to go into a game against the Huskies and know that you're not going to be able to pass the ball? You don't have a downfield like throwing threat of a QB, and knowing that's completely off the table, and knowing that you're now giving up these late game comebacks. How do you stop a team like Washington from exploiting that? And I honestly don't know. Like, when your QB's longest completion of the day was 16 yards, that says a lot and none of it good. Can't really put this one on your receivers either. Like, for what it's worth, they did as much as they could with what they had. And your running game looked pretty good as well. The problem is that on defense, it's a depth thing. That's really ultimately what it comes down to. And this team is only going to go as far as the defense carries it, and never has that been more true. But again, you start grinding teams down, teams start grinding you down, and eventually the depth is going to have to step up and prove itself at some point. Like, you're not going to keep squeaking out wins like this against better teams than Minnesota. And that's not to take anything away from Klaw Mullings and Donovan Edwards. When I sit here and say, like, the running game it can't be the only thing that goes right on offense, like, that's not at all to take anything away from Klaw Mullings and Donovan Edwards, who ended up with two touchdowns and 145 yards on the ground on Saturday. But how long can you keep it up? Especially when teams know that you're not throwing the ball because you don't really have a QB capable of keeping a defense honest. They're grinding out there and doing a phenomenal job of it. But at some point, now teams are starting to figure out that is kind of the key to keeping you in check. And I would expect that a team of the caliber of Washington we'll be able to ultimately figure that out, exploit it, and ultimately it's not going to, I don't think, end particularly well for the Wolverines here. Let's move on from the Michigan State portion of things. Just gloss over all of that. Okay, I guess real quick we can talk about that embarrassment. You at least looked like you belonged on the same field in the first half on Saturday, and that was ultimately about it. Like, you're making some decent plays. You were actually keeping up and looking like a legit team. And then in the second half, that was pretty much over. Couldn't move the ball on the first possession of the third quarter, and it never honestly really got any better from there. Blowout game, mistakes were being made, and ultimately you got whatever that was. And worst part is it doesn't really get any better because you got to take on Oregon on Friday. Really looking forward to that. Yeah, you get 30 seconds out of me out of Michigan State because that's really all there is to talk about them, quite honestly. Real quick before we get out of here, let's have a little bit of fun, shall we, with the rest of the NFL. Other things happened over the weekend that had absolutely nothing to do with your local team, obviously, because that team did not play this weekend. So shall we do a little bit of overreacting to the rest of the week that was in the National Football League? If we could, Maestro, the music, please. So this week, per the good folks at CBS Sports, your overreactions for the week, I'll tell you what's real and what is oh so very overreactionary. We start with the Washington Commanders. The overreaction being stated is that they're going to win the NFC East. And I'm sorry, I can't buy it. I mean, quite the credit here to be given to Jaden Daniels and Dan Quinn that we're even talking about them being in this conversation, but I don't buy it. I don't buy it for a second. Daniels has played quite well. He's now had consecutive games scoring 38-plus points. No other team in the league has had multiple games with 200-plus rushing yards this season either, but Cliff Kingsbury's gotten it done. They do lead the NFC East right now. But you know what? I can't buy into this until I see what they can actually do against Philly and Dallas. Philly is certainly scuffling a bit right now. Dallas has not done well. I feel really good about the Lions going and playing them, let me tell you what. But I need a couple more. What I really need to see is I need the Commanders to go and beat Philly at home. And I need them to go and beat Dallas before I'm really willing to sit here and say, yes, this is it. This is the team that's going to take the NFC East. Because I can't say I buy it right now. What I will say, though, and this leads into the next overreaction per CBS, the Bears made a mistake taking Caleb Williams over Jaden Daniels. My, Jaden's looking like the real deal. Is he not? It's not even close at this point. Like, this kid is, I mean, history-making, that's all there's to it. He has the highest completion percentage in a four-game span since the NFL-AFL merger. He's got an 80% completion rate, 200 rushing yards in a four-game span. The only player in the last checks. Now, it's 54 years to do that. He is the reason that Washington is even being talked about as potentially the best team in the NFC East. It's all because of this guy. Is it fair to say Chicago is really kind of should be regretting their decision right now? I would say absolutely. It's also kind of one of those things where I'm not entirely convinced that Daniels would thrive in Chicago's offense, though. So thus far, what Caleb Williams has done, he's completed 61% of his passes for 787 yards, 3 touchdowns, 4 picks. This team is 2-2. They're pretty much on the backs of their defense, not because of anything Caleb Williams has done. But we were even asking earlier in the season, like, were they better off just keeping Justin Fields here? Which suggested to me that while, yes, Jaden Daniels has thus far shown himself to be the superior QB in this draft class, I feel like it's not so much that Caleb Williams is necessarily bad as it is that Chicago just doesn't know what to do with him. Because Justin Fields didn't do terribly thus far for the Steelers. Like, that team is currently sitting 3-1 with Fields as their starter. 3 touchdowns and 1 pick there. He's completing like 70% of his passes. I don't think it's a Caleb Williams problem. It wasn't a Justin Fields problem. It's a Chicago problem. They, for whatever reason, cannot seemingly work. Like, they thought, oh, Justin Fields was the problem here. We're going to solve everything by throwing him to the curb. And as it turns out, that did not at all go the way that Chicago hoped it would. I will agree, certainly reality, that Daniels is him. But I'm not closing the book on Caleb Williams as much as just Chicago just does not know what to do with any of their QBs. Here's one for you. The Colts should move on from Anthony Richardson. He got injured again. And once again, the backup comes in, and the Colts offense is doing just fine without him. Be it Uncle Rico, Gardner Minshew, or Joe Flacco. What is it with, just as an aside here, what is it with Joe Flacco somehow managing to come in and just look like the Joe Flacco of old, the Joe Flacco with the Super Bowl ring for like five games a season? Apparently, he's just elite as long as he only has to play like a handful of games in any given year. This is just so weird. But once again, the issue here is Anthony Richardson going to be able to be healthy long-term for Indy? Is it time for the Colts to go back to the drawing board? I think it might be. I get he's a top five draft pick. He's only been in this league for a year and change. I think it's reality. I will disagree with CBS Sports on this. I don't think it's an overreaction. The Colts should be moving on from him. Obviously, you don't have the guy necessarily right now. I don't think anyone believes that Gardner Minshew is going to ever be a top-tier NFL-caliber starter, or even a mid-tier NFL-caliber starter. Joe Flacco only has about five games of this in him. But I think it's really time to start questioning, can Anthony Richardson be a long-term solution for a team? Can he stay healthy enough to be that guy? I don't know that he can. I don't think he can. And then when he is healthy, he's only completing about half of his passes. I think it's absolutely time to start exploring your options. Maybe you start tanking this thing to see what you can turn up in the draft. You don't like to cut bait on a QB this soon in his career, but at this point, you got to be looking elsewhere this offseason. I don't think there's any way around that. Now we turn to the coaching carousel, which I'm sure will be starting not necessarily any day now, but there's at least one seat that's getting hot. Doug Peterson will be the first coach fired. That's the overreaction. The Jags are 0-4. And this is a team that really had everything going for it for a while. You had a franchise QB in Trevor Lawrence coming off of the disaster that was the Urban Meyer era. But you were poised for a minute to be able to really make runs in the AFC South. You were poised to be able to go and make these runs and go out there and win what was really not a good division. That's not going to happen now. Houston has far surpassed everybody. You had your moment and squandered it. Will he be the first coach fired? That I'm not so certain about, because, I mean, there's certainly a couple guys you could throw out there. Knowing how Carolina is like forever a revolving door, Dave Canales could very well be out the door, depending on how things go for Andy Dalton from here on out. Or perhaps, you get Brian Daboll out of New York. But I would say right now that I'm leaning towards reality on it. He would seemingly be the guy who has the best chance to get fired. Trevor Lawrence played better this week, but your defense was just not good. They get 435 yards. They're inconsistent. But they play the Colts, Bears, and the Patriots coming up. If you go 1-2 or, God forbid, 0-4 in that stretch, yeah, I think you might be right. Peterson is probably a goner. We got to go. Jesse Kelly's up next after ABC News covers the world at 7 o'clock on WMIC AM and W237 EQ FM Sandusky. Go Lions. Talk to you Friday.